So, welcome all to the last meeting we're having with the special still in place. So if there's anybody who wants to join the group, if you join in the next couple of days, you'll get a two-for-one special. In the chat, there is a link you can go to get the to join the group. So again, welcome all, and I'm going to now mute all. And as per usual, you will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment. Please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. And later on this evening, probably, or latest tomorrow, the contents of the deck in PDF format, as well as the audio track and the contents of the chat window, will go up on our website if you want to review the material or pass on that information to other people. And I think with that, I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And first of all, I did put a message on the forum a week or so ago saying that the cupboard was bare. We had nothing in the pipeline for Q&A. So many thanks to all the people who tonight are going to be giving presentations. And you actually filled up the agenda for us. So thanks for that. So carrying on, first off, I have a question for everybody. Occasionally, I think everybody knows I have a dedicated data partition, and I keep my active data files on drive D in Windows. And it's only about 4 gigabytes because I only keep the files that I'm actually using, typically my email messages and spreadsheets I'm working on, that kind of thing. And so when I finish my session, I use Free File Sync to back up all of the new files and the updated files from my data drive, my hard drive, to a USB flash drive. And I do the same thing with the same drives in Linux. Occasionally, when I plug my USB drive into the laptop, Windows will pop up this message and says, there's a problem with this drive. Scan now to fix it. But when it checks, and I always check it because sometimes it's legitimate, but most of the time it says, no, there was no problem, which I find really weird. So if anybody knows why that happens, I'd be very interested. It's interesting the way they phrase things. I mean, here's the, when you say, go ahead and scan the drive, it says there might be a problem. There might be a problem with some files on this device. Scan and fix recommended. So you click on scan and fix, and it says, we found errors on this drive. We found errors on this drive. So now you can choose to repair the drive. And when you click on repair the drive, off it goes. It scans things for quite a while. Well, a few minutes anyway. And then it comes back and it says, it scanned the drive and no errors were found. So typical Microsoft, we found errors, but no errors were found. I mean, you explain the logic to me if you can. And so I'm not sure why that is. Chris came up with a couple of ideas. First of all, he says maybe the drive hadn't been safely ejected. I don't think that's the case. In Windows, I have the little safely eject icon permanently on the taskbar. And I'm pretty careful about actually hitting that to remove the drive. And in Linux, I actually have a batch file, a bash script file that uninstalls the drive for me. So typically the drive does get safely ejected. And then the second thing Chris said was that a dirty bit may have been set. Well, I didn't know what a dirty bit was, so here's some information about dirty bits for those of you who also don't know what a dirty bit is. It can be because there are outstanding changes to the drive. This is the it was removed to prematurely problem, or there was corruption on the volume. And if the dirty bit is set, then Windows runs check this to check things out. And the interesting thing is you can actually find out about the dirty bit. So next time this happens to me, I'm going to try and remember to do this. You use this utility program to query the dirty bit on a particular drive, and it will tell you it's either dirty or not dirty. Not quite sure what you do once it finds that, especially if it's dirty. I guess it's going to run check disk and sort it out for me. Anyway, if you have those kind of issues and you don't know what dirty bits are, then there's some information for you. Okay, carrying on. Chris has got his share. About Bill Gates. Wait, somebody said.
I said wait. Me. Firstly, is this PAT 32
or NTFS?
I beg your pardon?
USB key formatted as FAT32 or NTFS?
It's probably FAT because it's only 8 gig, I think, or 16 gig. But I'm not sure. I have to check.
My first suggestion
is to reformat it as FAT, as NTFS, because it has better error checking and recovery than FAT or FAT32 drives.
Right.
My second suggestion is to reformat it with whatever, because maybe for some reason the original format didn't take. There's not just a dirty bit, but a wavery bit that goes back and forth. But if you reformat as NTFS after copying your data, of course, then that may solve your problem. You, of course, have to have most Unix systems or Linux systems these days, I believe, read NTFS, so that shouldn't be a problem. But NTFS is a much safer file system than any of the FATs.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. I'll check that out. Okay. So, Chris, it's over to you.
Yeah, okay. So I came across this article, which I thought was kind of interesting. Bill Gates, he still is quite vocal on a lot of things, and he runs his own blog where he puts up interesting articles and so forth. So a while ago, he had a challenge to the company OpenAI, and he wanted them to train an artificial intelligence that could pass an advanced placement biology exam and make it capable of answering questions that it was not specifically trained for. And he chose the advanced placement biology exam because in order to pass that, he said that it's more than simply regurgitating facts, which is what most of the AIs out there now are doing, is they're just, you know, just finding other facts elsewhere and just kicking it back. So he says that you really have to think critically about biology in order to pass this. And he thought it would keep them busy for 2 or 3 years. Well, he finished it in a couple of months. And when it was given the test, out of 60 multiple choice questions, it got 59 right. And then there were 6 open-ended questions that he says got outstanding answers. And an outside expert actually scored the GPT on it got a 5, which is the highest score possible, so the equivalent of an A or an A plus in a college level biology course. So he thought that was pretty cool. So next. So the highlights of this article, and I've got the URL there and I pasted it into the chat as well. So he has how he defines AI and some of the things he expects to come out of it, productivity enhancements, healthcare improvements. He's really big on healthcare, education. He talks a little bit about what he thinks the risks and problems are and what the next frontiers will be. So I thought it was an interesting article to read. So if you're interested in it at all, the URL, as I say, is in the chat. And check it out.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I was reading online somewhere. People are suggesting that they should hold up on the development of AI. I think that ship sailed quite a while ago.
Yeah.
Okay, moving along. We have a share from Jeff Dubois. Jeff was running Windows 8 on his 8.1 on his laptop and wanted to go to 10. But interestingly, and because it's a laptop, the product key label was on the bottom of the laptop and it had been worn off. So he didn't know what the product key was to enter when Windows in its wisdom asked for that. But he found this utility called Windows Key Viewer, which basically worked just as it said it would, grab the product key and enable Jeff to install Windows 10 with no problems. And don't go mad writing down this this product key on the screen here. It's not Jeff's. It's actually from the developer's website. So it's probably a fictional one anyway. And for those of you who are, Tom says take a photo of your computer labels. That's not a bad idea. For those of you who are moving on and buying new computers to upgrade, as it were, to Windows 11, I just remind you that Chris and I did a couple of articles a couple of years ago, I think it was, on setting up a new computer. And one of the things we suggested was creating a maintenance log and basically writing down in the log, or documenting in the log, all of the information that's pertinent to the computer and things like activation keys for various pieces of software. So you always have it available in a file on your computer and also in all your backups, of course. Okay, so moving along, a follow-up to our Fraud Watch program. It turns out March is Fraud Prevention Month. Who knew? And if you've looked at our Fraud Watch page on the website, you'll find that there's all kinds of examples of different kinds of scams, and there are all kinds of red flags to help people identify them. But we just had some input from one of the board members, actually, who got an email. And she believes it's a possible romance scam. So here's the gist of romance scams from the RCMP website. Somebody creates a false identity and then pretends to romance somebody else, the victim. And they're trying to gain trust. And eventually they'll decide that they really need money in a hurry, or they want you to invest in something because it's a really good deal. And they basically want you to wire them money. And of course, that's the last you ever see of your money. So, Karen, if you're going to talk to these slides, you'll need to unmute your microphone. And okay. She's ready to go. So here we go. One member's experience.
So this is as a response to Alan's call out, the cupboard's bare. And I said, well, here might be a fun one. So, Alan, thank you for preparing the slide deck for me based on some of the points that I sent off to you. And there was quite a bit of exchange in the pre-meeting prelude, I guess, to this meeting about people talking about things that they're doing to discourage people or dissuade people. So Alan and I have taken a pretty light and humorous approach to this whole thing, there are some serious potential undertones for people. And I really feel for the people that may have been involved with something like this. So it started at the beginning of March. Just out of the blue, I got this email from what looked like a gentleman. And it was expressing how he had found my email on a meetup site and was quite taken with who I seemed to be. And there was quite a lengthy explanation about how he'd come to this. And he had hoped that his email wouldn't have upset me, but he was hoping that he maybe could get to know me personally and professionally. And he included a couple of pictures of himself. And Alan, if only he did look like Brad Pitt. So next slide. Right away, for those of you who don't know me, I worked in compliance and enforcement for Health Canada, so Spidey Senses would offer that, plus all that I just do and all of the excellent training that you guys have done in the past. So some of my Spidey Senses went off immediately on this thing, like, who is this person? Because I had no idea who they were, name not known to me. The email address and the name the person were using didn't match. It had a very familiar tone about it, not saying, hey, Karen, I met you at this meeting and I've just been thinking about you and would like to reconnect. Or, Karen, you're a friend of so-and-so. No, nothing. Nothing like that. So really overly familiar for someone who is just trying to make initial contact. The person's name was not part of the group that meetup group that he said he found me in. And the hour was like 2 or 3 in the morning that the email was sent. Moving on. And again, Alan's very flattering. This was a picture of me in better days, perhaps. So there were enough things in the email, though, that I thought, well, maybe this could be possible. And me being the perhaps overly trusting at times person that I am, and my nickname is Pollyanna Sunshine, so overly positive sometimes, I thought, well, maybe this could be something. So I wrote back and said, refresh my memory. Who are you and how did you find me? And also, because of some of the pictures, I thought, it doesn't look like it's in Canada. So where do you reside? Very short email. And I didn't provide anything in Meetup. I'm just known as Kay. Stuart will have some fun with that. Just known as Kay. There's no address. There's no phone number. There's nothing. So all there was my email address. And he had requested photos of me, which were not provided. Moving on. So over the course of the next few weeks, I received some more lengthy emails in response. There was lots of personal history involved. I found out about being a widower and his son and his mother and his heritage and where he went to school and where he works and all sorts of other kinds of things, and that he responded that he lived in Toronto, and there were more pictures that were provided, including a LinkedIn profile. So I immediately went to LinkedIn. I didn't use the link he provided, but I went to LinkedIn and tried to look him up. There were a number of people by that name, and interestingly enough, there was another person by the same name that had the same profession. Interesting. So again, spidey senses going off. The latest emails, the name and the email now matched. So there'd been a change in the email being used. Again, very overly familiar, and I learned about all sorts of his preferences and how he would interact with his future partner. Lots of pictures showing lavish lifestyles with titles like pictures of me and my Jaguar, pictures of me here, pictures of me there. So some interesting pictures, thankfully all clothed and mostly head and shoulder shots. But again, the hour of the emails were 11 o'clock at night, 3 o'clock in the morning, and the natures of the details were provided were just very bold. And the LinkedIn looked really suspicious to me, because for someone who who had said that they were a contractor, I would have thought there would have been a lot more details to try, and everybody's using LinkedIn now for work reasons, so I would have thought there would have been far more detail in the LinkedIn. And I did some other searches, and I couldn't seem to find any other really online presence for him on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or any of these other kind of things. So some spidey senses going off round two. And next. So I graciously, keeping with my personality, said thank you, but no thank you. And I thanked him for his interest and how flattered I was, and that I would not be writing back, though, because I have a very busy life. Can't even meet up with my friends that I have. I don't have enough time to meet up with my existing friends, let alone new friends. And I also was dropping some pretty subtle hints that it's a very unusual manner to be approached, that one has to be careful in today's world, especially as a woman, for phishing scams, scammers, people not representing who they are. With the advances in AI technology, anybody can be anybody now. To which I received, thank you, I understand this, of course. You have to be careful, and a whole bunch more detail in that email too. So moving on. What struck me about this whole thing was that it was an unusual contact. It wasn't through a dating site, which is how my understanding of most of this happens. And I thought I had a fairly limited or low online presence, that yes, I have Facebook. I don't post anything and I have very limited information there, was my thought. Same thing with Twitter and Instagram. Thought it was pretty low presence and again, not much detail there. So I wasn't really expecting something of this nature to be on my radar because I don't know how people would really find me or make the connections. So I thought, okay, obviously there's stuff out there that I'm not aware of. So I started to look at what OPCUG has posted about how you go about checking and protecting yourself through those great archives and things that you guys have, which is great. And then I started to read some other posts about what else should I be doing beyond that to further protect myself or maybe explore that I'm in areas that I didn't expect. Moving on. So I looked at, has my email been pawned? Because this would be pretty disastrous for me knowing how important my email address is for me. And there wasn't really anything unexpected. I've had a couple hits in the past, but those had been dealt with and nothing there that showed up. I rechecked Equifax and TransUnion. All my accounts seem fine. On Meetup, where this person claims to have met me, I really further limited my profile there and put less information. And then I did a few more what I thought were deeper internet searches, and all seems fine for me. And then I thought, let's go see a little if I could find a little more on this guy. So he had given me his LinkedIn picture. So I did a reverse image search. And on that, I got 6 browser hits, and I went through each of those. And on Yandex, there were 6 listings for an Instagram account. And wasn't that fascinating when I went into that Instagram profile that seemed to match that picture? Because I saw all kinds of wild stuff on that, which is fascinating, disturbing, and contrary content to who he was presenting himself as, Gabrielle, or on these Instagram that I found, Andre. And I don't think he's based in Canada at all. I think it's Costa Rica or Mexico or who knows where. So from the get-go, I was pretty sure it was a romance scam, but I'll never know for sure. So I left with a little bit of a hee-hee, should I be flattered that I was sought out with a very limited presence or what I thought was to be the case. Moving on to the next slide. So I was having this thought and having a little bit of a chuckle about to the depths that this person had gone in and what I had learned through this whole process. Well, what comes in the next day is my Malwarebytes newsletter. And the first item on that was a person who scams the scammers in romance scams. She was absolutely hysterical when I listened to the interview that she did with the Malwarebytes fellow. And some parts of it were areas that I would never go, and not within my personality, but she was quite playful with a lot of them. And she would say something like, oh, your ear just looks so delicious. Could you send me a picture of your ear? And then she would take a friend, lie them on the floor, pour them over with ketchup, and put a knife beside, covered in ketchup, and say that this was my latest delicious afternoon activity. And she said they didn't last very long as scammers, but some of them went on for quite some time, evidently. So she was quite funny, and it just helped to put a little bit of levity to what I was experiencing. So I thought it was the end of it, but I was wrong. There was a sequel. And so Gabrielle or Andre or whoever this was, Alan and I prepared these decks on the weekend. They wrote last, I don't know, Thursday or something. I was absolutely shocked. I couldn't believe after how I had, you know, kindly said thank you, but no thank you, wrote back. But of course, during all this time and all of my research, I was taking some screenshots just in case. So I sent back an email saying, see pic attached, about 15 question marks, saying basically, sorry, I won't be writing back anymore, and please don't write me anymore. So I wrote to Alan. I said, we'll see if I end up with a trilogy out of this, but I would say I'm a week free of whoever, Andre, Gabrielle, or whoever is. But I thought it was so a bit of a fun and light story to share with everyone, but there are potential serious consequences for these things, and I never thought in my experience that I would have any kind of experience like this, but I for sure learned lots, and I'm really grateful that I don't have much posted online because I can't imagine what some people must experience. Mm-hmm. So that's my little light story for Fraud Month.
Very good, Karen. That's really wonderful. I'm very impressed with all the research you put into that too.
Before we actually move on, I would urge a little bit of caution on anybody who thinks that this is necessarily a good idea to engage with these people. Not only is there every possibility that you could slip up or something, but also you could get put onto a list of, oh, here's a likely candidate, and you may get a lot of other nuisance stuff come your way. So just be a little bit careful. I've also played games with scammers in the past, but there could be downsides to it as well. Most of the experts, say just don't respond at all, don't engage at all, is the safest thing to do. So, but very interesting story. Thanks very much, Karen.
And Alan, I see that there were a bunch of passing comments. I didn't get a chance. Is there anything to respond to there?
I don't think so. Stuart likes it. He's giving you the A-OK sign here.
Yeah, Tom had some ideas about things like, where was it? Wise to do the search pictures on it, search their email address. He said that the hours could be real. Somebody who's married, who's avoiding their wife, I guess, or something like that. And he said you can Google the phrase open source intelligence for more search techniques and check the originating IP on the email, although that's a little bit tricky to look in the headers on there because it usually will go through a lot of different sources. There are some sites that can track back where it really came from. And I think that's it.
Yeah, the other thing to do is to have 20 different email addresses and use the throwaway ones for sites like Facebook and whatever.
Yeah.
So if they do catch you, then you just throw that email address away and don't use it ever again. Okay, Chris.
I see Tom's got his hand up.
You have to unmute yourself, Tom.
DuckDuckGo has a facility if you put in their browser extension, it will create email addresses in the form of some random set of characters at DuckDuckGo.com, and it will forward these messages on to you after deleting any trackers. And you can create a new email address for anybody, for use with anybody or any organization. And it's basically unlimited, and they all get forwarded to you if someone sends an email. And I haven't tried it, but I imagine you can delete those if you get tired of anything being forwarded.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you can actually delete them. That would be a critical aspect of it, I would think.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Tom. Okay, so next, Chris has an update on Bing.
Yeah, so last week I gave a rant on the Bing Discover icon, and I said at the time that I thought Microsoft might come to their senses about it or be beaten over the head that they did something bad and decide that they will actually correct it, and sure enough, they actually did. So, I had a big lengthy thing on how to use a registry edit to get rid of that Bing Discover icon, and you can now actually update it through the Edge settings. Next. One more. So it works in at least the version of Edge I was running at the time that I tested this, 111.0.1 1.661.54, and you can go into Edge to update it. If you, I would suggest that make sure you're on the latest release. So if you go to the meatball icon in the top right-hand corner, and then go to Help and Feedback and About Microsoft Edge, from that screen you're able to force an update. And so I would suggest doing that. Then once you've done the update, you click on the meatballs icon and you go to Settings. Next. And then in the settings dialog box on the left-hand side, you go to sidebar, and then you scroll way down. There's a whole bunch of stuff, and you get to the point where it says app and notification settings and app-specific settings and discover, and you click on that, and you can turn off the option to show discover. And as soon as you do that, that little Bing icon that you see near the top right-hand corner will disappear.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So next we have a little item here on Excel from Bob Harris. And I think, Bob, you're going to talk to these slides. When you unmute yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. I bought in November of 22, a package of Microsoft Office 21. It was a very good deal, and it was $20 or $30, and installed very well. And as I began to develop more Excel files, it became very annoying because I couldn't open an Excel file from Explorer. I had to keep going through Excel, open a new file, and search it. And I tried a few times to resolve this, a few little things, but it never seemed to work. And other than that, Excel worked very, very well. So I came across this little fix, and I went into Settings, and I found the apps. I searched installed apps. I found Microsoft Office. I'm getting weary now. I'm going to be uninstalling it. But no, I didn't uninstall it. There was another alternative. When I clicked the three little dots, the ellipsis, I had an option came up. I had an option to modify it or uninstall it. And my little video I found suggested this was going to work. And lo and behold, it was minutes of effort here. I clicked modify, and the next screen, I came to two options, a quick repair or an online repair. I pressed a quick one. In a matter of 2 minutes, it resolved the whole problem. I had no idea that fix was so easy or where to find it. And it was simple, nothing in the registry, nothing, no reinstalling, and but I had a one-time install. I couldn't reinstall it again from my bargain basement price. But anyway, that worked very well. I think Alan and Chris, and thank you for the slides, Alan and Chris, making this, may have some more wise advice on this issue.
Just a quick word on the difference between the quick repair and online repair. Quick repair basically goes through a lot of the registry settings for the app, shortcuts, various things like that, and just make sure that they're set correctly. If that doesn't work, then you go to the next one, which is an online repair, which basically reinstalls the whole app. So it'll bring down the entire program and reinstall all the files and do everything that the quick repair did as well. So do them in that order. If quick repair doesn't fix it, then try the online repair. It definitely takes longer and it will download the entire thing, but it does more stuff to fix things up. And to Microsoft's credit, their repair functionality in their applications is usually pretty good. Okay, just going further on that just a little bit, for fixing Microsoft Store apps. So if you have a Microsoft Store app, when you go to the settings and apps, installed apps, you will, if you click on the ellipsis, what you see there is you won't see things like what was the other one that he actually had on the screen? The option to do modify. You won't see modify there. You will see advanced options, and all Microsoft Store apps should have that advanced options. So you click on that, and then it'll come up with a thing where you can do a reset on the app, and you can do either a repair or a reset. And this is very similar to that idea of either a quick repair or an online repair. So the repair will just try to fix the app in place, and the full reset will actually do a complete reinstall of the application itself. It will also get rid of all your personalized settings for the app in the thoughts that maybe it's one of your personalized settings that's corrupting the app and not allowing it to function properly. So always do the repair first, see if it works. If it doesn't, then go back and do the reset. And that should be consistent with all store apps. Other programs, if you have other programs that aren't working properly, however they're not working, you know, whether it's not opening or whether it's, you know, any sort of behavior that you're not expecting in the app. So a lot of programs do have those abilities to either do a repair or modify or reinstall. Places to look. If you're in Windows 10, it'd be Settings Apps. In Windows 11, it's Settings Apps Installed Apps. And then, so you may have options in there to be able to do a repair, modify, or reinstall. Within the program itself, often on the Help menu, there might be something about repairing or modifying or reinstalling the app. And then I think as a last resort, you can try uninstalling and reinstalling the application. If you go to that extent, make sure that you have everything you need to reinstall that app, including the installation file or where it gets downloaded from, and make sure you have your license keys. Often when you uninstall an app, the license keys will be left in the registry, so if you do reinstall it, you don't have to worry about having the license key, but that's not a universal. So make sure you have any license keys that you may need to actually be able to activate the program afterwards. So just some ideas there on how to fix other programs other than Excel.
Tom says you can also go to settings and choose default apps by file type, and you may get repair or troubleshooting options, which are useful.
Okay. Yeah.
And he says many problems can be solved by a reinstall, choose the latest version, and they do keep settings and data.
My experience has been usually they do. But I have seen instances where I was prompted for the license key on the reinstall. So it's not universal. Usually it is there for sure. That's a good tip on the choose default apps and having a repair or troubleshooting option. I never noticed that before. So that's a good one to check out for sure.
Yeah, I've not had great success with Windows troubleshooters. It usually tells me to go and ask somebody who knows something. Useless. Okay, next up we have Bob Walker, who's going to be sharing his screen, I think, and telling us all about UPS, the United Parcel Service, I believe. Oh, no, not that. The other UPS.
Okay, you're going to have to enable my screen sharing, Chris.
You should be. Oh, I thought I had. My course. Okay, you should be good to go there now.
Okay, the wonders of modern technology.
Well, did you drop out and come back or anything?
Yes, I did. I had a little bit of a glitch.
Okay, that's what caused it, because I did make you a co-host, and I guess when you dropped out and came back, I didn't notice that you had done that. So, okay.
Okay, you've got the full slide there.
Yep, it's going good.
Okay, so tonight we're going to be looking at uninterruptible power supplies, or UPSs. Last session we looked at surge protectors, and these protect electronic devices, including your computers, battery chargers, modems, TVs, etc., from voltage spikes on the power line. However, if you wanted to protect some equipment that could be damaged by a sudden loss of power, for example, a hard disk drive that's susceptible to data corruption, or you want to protect critical gear that can't ever go down, such as a CPAP machine, a ventilator, an oxygen generator, you shouldn't be looking at surge protector at all. Instead, you need an uninterruptible power supply, and most of these have built-in surge protection. A UPS is also great for anyone who wants to their home Wi-Fi, their VoIP internet-enabled telephone, and their internet to stay online during short power outages or brownouts. Adding a UPS can keep you online and connected in case you need to reach emergency services. For example, if you have a VoIP telephone, you need internet access to dial 911. Or if you're in the middle of a round of your favorite online game and don't want to be booted out. Most UPSs are basically a surge protector, a battery charger, an automatic voltage regulator, a cutover relay, and a power inverter. And the inverter turns the battery stored power into usable line power, all wrapped into one unit. And the size of this battery determines how long it can provide the power. And the capacity of the inverter in watts determines how much power it can put out at any given time. And this output is usually often listed as volt amps, but most people understand it better as watts. UPSs usually operate in one of two ways. In the first way, the devices plugged into the UPS are always powered from the internal battery pack through the inverter. And the power coming in from the line is used to keep the battery charged. So if the power coming in dies because of a power failure, you just keep drawing on the battery. This is usually cheap UPSs or very old design UPSs. Most of them have the second way of operating, and that's that the internal battery charger and the device is plugged into the UPS are powered from the incoming power line until a power failure or a voltage drop or like a brownout or a winky. When a relay switches the devices over to an inverter powered from the internal battery pack. And this is what most UPSs are currently on the market are designed as. This is a block diagram of a typical UPS. At the input, you have an electromagnetic interference filter, a surge suppressor, a tap goes off down to the battery charger, and the rest goes to the automatic voltage regulator. And the cutover relay can either conceptually be part of the voltage regulator or at the output, depending on the specific design of the unit. Larger UPS units with extra power and features can help home offices and workstations keep up and running during business hours, or at least keep you up and running long enough to save the work and safely shut down the equipment. If you have a lot of important data on a desktop computer, an external hard drive, or on a network attached storage unit, you may need a UPS to prevent your drives from losing data in the event of a sudden power outage. Keep in mind that on a lot of computers and a lot of network attached storage, any data that you just moved over may still be in the cache or instead of on the actual drive. And so if you suddenly lose power, the cache loses power and you've lost that data. So a UPS helps prevent that from happening. For example, I live out in a country where power failures and power winkies are all too common events. So I have two UPSs. One of them powers my internet connection, my wireless router, my network attached storage, the VoIP phone adapter, the cordless phone system base station, and I have a cell phone repeater because the nearest tower is quite a ways away, and this gives me my own private cell phone tower on the premises. This UPS gives me about 90 minutes of service before I need to switch over to a generator or some other form of backup power. The other power is my home theater system. And this UPS is mainly to protect against power winkies. because if a few years ago I had a brief power winky, and it took out my satellite receiver with the PVR in it, and I lost about 200 hours worth of recording. Also, in the event of a full power failure, the UPS can't keep the whole home theater system and the big screen TV and everything up and running for long. But it gives me time to properly shut everything else down while switching over to a PVR to record whatever I was watching at the time so I can continue watching it later. Now, most UPSs have some sort of audible alarm to indicate when the UPS is operating on backup power. And some UPSs may have extra features such as LCD panels, which give status and other information. They may have power outlets for USB and or 12 volts. And they may also have some surge protection for your phone line, network cables, and or any coax lines you have, like cable TV or satellite TV. Some UPSs, in combination with a USB connection to the computer and an app installed on the computer, can trigger the computer to do a safe shutdown during a power failure if you're not there. Just keep in mind that some of the apps from some of the companies may not be available for all operating systems, and this includes any Apple or Linux operating systems. Some UPS do's and don'ts. Do make sure the output capacity of the UPS matches or exceeds the power draw of the equipment plugged into it, and that it can power the equipment for the required time period. Do not plug a UPS into a surge protector or vice versa, aside from potentially overloading either unit and tripping a fuse or breaker. You also risk canceling the canceling out the surge protection instead of doubling it up. Now, conceptually, I don't quite understand how this works, but when I read about this, I went and unplugged my UPS from a surge protector and plugged it straight into the wall. But I'm not an electrical engineer, so I don't understand why it's necessary, but reviews on surge protectors bring up this point, and the manual for virtually any surge protector or any UPS also brings it up, so it's worth keeping in mind. You should use an extension cord with a UPS or for a surge protector for that matter, because on surges, the power draw can be quite big. If you must use an extension cord, make sure it is rated for at least 13 amps, which is basically a 14 gauge power cord. The normal household 120 volt circuit is rated at 15 amps, so that is coming close. And using a UPS to power high drain devices like space heaters or curling irons, kettles, coffee makers, that sort of thing, can damage the UPS's internal components, degrade the battery, and void its warranty. There's a great review of some UPSs at the Wirecutter website. This review also contains a lot of general good information on UPSs. If you want more information on the Wirecutter website itself, it's a great product review website, and it's well worth visiting if you're looking for reviews on things. And if you want even more information on UPSs in general, Wikipedia has a good page. I gave a couple of presentations back in 2021 on other backup power sources, and there are the URLs. There's one on power solar chargers, And there's a follow-up I did on other backup sources like generators and inverters. And on Monday, Alan forwarded me some questions on UPSs. The next slides give the questions and their answers, and they're very good questions. And so the first one was, what's the lifespan of an uninterruptible power supply? Now, the lifespan is pretty much dependent on the battery life. And the battery life, typical battery life given for most UPSs by the manufacturers is 2 to 6 years. They always give a range because the exact number depends on the number of discharge and recharge cycles the UPS undergoes. And that's a big factor of how often power failures happen in your area. Now, you should test the battery condition at least once a year or so by unplugging the UPS from the wall with all your devices running. If the UPS doesn't power them for as long as you expect it to, it's probably time to replace the batteries. CyberPower, APC, and other manufacturers sell replacement batteries usually directly or sometimes through Amazon. Some third-party battery makers make the replacement batteries for various UPS models as well. If the manufacturer can't sell your replacement battery, there's usually third-party batteries available, so keep that in mind. Like all electronics, the UPS unit itself won't last forever. But ideally, according to the Wirecutter review on UPSs, you should be able to replace a battery numerous times before you have to replace the entire unit. Now, that's what Wirecutter recommends. That said, some manufacturers recommend replacing the UPS itself when it is time for the second battery replacement. Whoops. There we go. Are the surge protectors in UPS power supplies more robust and longer lasting than the surge protectors in power bars? You mentioned that the lifespan of power bar surge protectors is only 3 to 5 years, and I would rather not be replacing the UPS every 3 to 5 years. So in last week's presentation on surge protectors, I pointed out that the power bar type surge protectors didn't last forever, and I gave some information about this. And you can download the presentation from the OPCUG website to check this out. I couldn't find any comparable info on the surge protectors and UPSs. Keep in mind that it's the surge protection in UPS fails, it is UPS itself that will likely experience the brunt of any damage. And the surge energy ratings of UPSs tends to be lower than the rating of some of the better surge protectors. And I did some searches, and I couldn't find any further info on this. I'm going to make the assumption, which could be completely wrong, that they depend on the power conditioning circuitry of the UPS itself to provide some of the surge protection. But again, I couldn't find much information online to back this up. And that's it for this presentation.
Thanks a lot, Bob. That was great. There's lots of kudos in the chat, saying good information and people thinking that maybe they'll head that way to get themselves a UPS.
Yeah, I got one of my UPSs at Canada Computers several years ago. They had a sale on, and I don't have to check it every year because at least once a year I have a power failure that does that for me. That's a check of life. And 5 or 6 years later, the battery's still going strong. I got the other surge protector on a deal at Amazon Canada. There's lots of other places you can go, Best Buy, and whatever. So
hey, we're coming up on the final 10, or we're into the final 10 right now. So if anybody has anything else that they wanted to either share or ask about, think about it. You can either unmute yourself or throw it into the chat. And we do have something from Karen. Question, ghost lines for internet. Can they be used as emergency phone and fax purposes? Karen, can you elaborate a little bit? I'm not 100% sure exactly what ghost lines are.
Maybe I'm using the wrong terminology. It's when you have a line coming into the house that runs your internet, but you don't have like a landline on it. It's just sitting there to provide internet. Is that?
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I forget what they call them. I think basically that is being run. The line itself is being run by Bell.
Right.
So.
Not the dry loop, are we, Chris?
Yeah, that's right. Dry loop. So I guess you could check with Bell to see whether it can be used for emergencies on a phone. It could be used for voice over IP type phone services. Certainly, if it's there for internet access, then you could use that internet access for voice over IP.
Well, I was just thinking if you had like an old-fashioned
landline
that could just plug into the wall, could you use it for emergency 911 if internet's down or things like that? It was a question. And the other one is that I have a printer that has fax capability, but I don't have any line attached to it. Does anybody know, can you use the dry loop as the fax mechanism? Because there's a number attached to it. If you want to just do outbound and maybe even inbound, I don't know.
Does anybody on the call tonight have any experience with either of those two aspects?
Has a fax capability, and I have that plugged in through my voice over internet protocol phone adapter. Generally, I keep it actually unplugged, except when I need to actually send or receive a fax. But it'll work through like an internet telephone line, as well as through a Bell or Rogers landline.
Yeah, we get the. I mean, it worked for you because it is plugged into a voice over IP adapter, so it's really using voice over IP, right? So we're having some comments in here that from a number of people saying Bell usually provides a splitter between voice and data, but doubt it'll work for voice with no number. We have Edward saying dry loops, dry lines do not normally support regular communications. Jeff says, to the best of his knowledge, you cannot use a dry loop number to send or receive calls. You can use a VoIP line on that dry loop, of course. So
now, the first house I lived in, they canceled the phone service before they rented it out to me. And I didn't bother to reinstate the phone service, but I could make calls out. I just couldn't receive any. Because unless Bell physically cuts the line, there's still going to be power, a couple volts. And if you plug a phone into it, you can make calls.
Interesting.
And I didn't know that, but the guy across the street was a Bell technician, and he told me that. So.
Okay.
Yeah, Stuart, I was a regular phone line, though.
That's right.
Talking here about a dry loop, which is designed to carry digital signals.
Well, I thought we were talking about ghost lines, which like completely threw me for a loop in the first place. But, you know.
A dry loop could be just the regular phone line without a phone number attached to it. So, you know, Stuart's experience here might carry through to that, where you can't make any incoming calls, but you could make outgoing calls. Maybe, I don't know. It's interesting. If anybody has a dry loop if you can try it out and report back to us whether you could make an outgoing phone call, that would be interesting to know for sure.
There is a special number you can call on your line that will tell you what your phone number is that you're calling from.
So you may be able to actually receive calls on it, at least until it gets reassigned.
Well.
Hey, Stu.
Oh.
Did you have the sound on the phone?
I can't remember. This was 45 years ago.
Oh, you didn't have a cell then.
Okay, if I can find a phone, I'll try it on my line because I took my house phone, which was a line, and moved it to a cell phone.
Yeah,
okay.
So I don't know if there's any power coming through now.
Yeah.
And I think they only allow the outgoing calls for a 911.
Okay.
Yeah. You can always just take the wire out and, wet your finger and put your finger across the wire and if it tickles.
Exactly. It's the dial phone I'm thinking of.
If you still have a jack accessible.
Lots of jacks.
If you could plug a phone in at some point and try making an outgoing phone call and just let us know if it works. Because that would be, anybody who's gone to just dry loop, that would be interesting to know for emergency purposes. Can you make outgoing phone calls?
That's exactly why I'm asking.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try to see if I still have one of my phones. I did a little cleanup.
And then it would also be interesting if I could hook the fax up because sometimes I just want to do fax and instead of going to one of the free fax services that you can use, if I can use my system. And I know that my dry loop has, thank you for correcting my terminology, the dry loop has a specific number attached to it. Like I've got the numbers, a 489 North Goring number attached to it, but I haven't really tried it and I'm not techie enough to know if I'm going to screw something up by doing it. So I'll let somebody else be maybe adventuresome and give it a try. You can see my adventure relates to romance scams only. So, the other thing I wanted to just ask Bob Walker, maybe you mentioned this, but I missed it. If you aren't home and you don't know there's a power outage and your UPS goes on, and then by the time you've returned home, your power is returned on. Is there a signal that the UPS gives you that there was a power outage and it kicked on during that time?
There are some of the premium UPSs that have a feature that will email you or a warning that the power has failed.
Your microwave should be flashing.
ECR.
Yeah. I don't have any of that stuff anymore, so that's why I ask.
A clock radio?
You need a cheap clock radio that you can use for testing.
Monitor my hydro usage?
Exactly.
if you touch your finger to the phone, you may detect a little voltage, but if someone rings you at that time, the voltage goes up to about 45 volts, which will surprise you.
Yeah.
Karen was asking about fax and dry loop and VoIP. A simple solution, two that come to mind. Fongo still offers a VoIP line for about $4.95 a month. They send you the ATA so you don't have to program it. And so if your fax machine was plugged into that, you should be able to go through their ATA and write out over the internet. The other option that might be available, one that I use, I don't know if it's still available, though I'm kind of grandfathered in, but the same company, Fibernetics, that owns Fongo, also has freephoneline.ca, and you used to be able to buy the SIP settings for the unlock key for the ATA for $60, and that's what I've been using for my home phone and my cottage phone since I think 2003 or 2004. So it's $0 a month and unlimited Canada-wide calling. But you can actually program You can program incoming fax to actually be converted and sent to you by email if you want as a PDF. Their server will handle it, or you can just have it answer the phone and go directly to your fax machine, and your outgoing fax, of course, would just go out. So those might be some options.
Thanks, Jeff. You just raised something. I have a, I don't know if I can do it through Skype or not. I have a Skype subscription for $2.99 a month, which gives me unlimited in Canada and, well, North America. So I never explored that, but that's an interesting one. I wonder if I can do it through Skype, although I probably have to have a Skype number to do that.
Are you able, with your Skype account, are you able to actually call regular phone numbers or just other Skype accounts?
No, I can call. I have a subscription that I can call any phone number.
And can you plug a phone into it? Or is it a headset?
I think it's just headset through the computer.
Yeah, that's probably the problematic part right there. You got to be able, it has to actually have the, it's not an RJ45. What's the phone plug called? Come on, tech guys.
RJ11.
RJ11. Yeah, okay. It has to have the RJ11 on it in order to plug your fax machine in.
Okay, that's cool. And I remember at one time you could send a fax via email. Can you still do that? Like if you had it scanned, you typed somewhere into the two, like it was an email, and then you put the address? Do you know if you can still do that stuff?
There are a couple of services. I haven't updated my webpage in a long time. I might still have something on there. I can just check quickly. But go ahead.
Why not take a photograph with your phone and send the photo?
It's by email, but it used to be that if you could send, it was an email, but it somehow converted it to fax, and it was acceptable as a fax.
Send photos by email. And you can take a photo of the page or whatever you want to fax out. It won't be a fax, but it'll actually be more detailed and sharper
than a fax, because a fax is only 100 to 200 lines per millimeter or inch, actually, I think it is. And so it's really low resolution. You're better off actually sending a picture of a page. Of course, it might be awkward with a whole bunch of documents, but then you can actually create a PDF with your phone and send the PDF.
Yeah, I get that, Tom. My particular application, it's sending it to things like doctor's offices, and they don't accept email, so I've had to send faxes, and that's what's causing me to pursue this.
There used to be a bunch of services. I have a list here. Of course, you know, the geological timescale on technology, a week is like 10 million years, right? But I have one called eFax, another service called FaxAway. There's one called FaxBetter, FaxZero.com, GotFreeFax, HelloFax, and K7. So those are...
Thanks, Jeff. I've used a number of those because they usually get a certain amount per month that you can send or a certain number of pages. So I've bounced around with some of those. But I just what triggered me is some of this other stuff that we've been talking about tonight. And I just wondered, is there a different way that I could be doing it through the dry loop from my fax that I already have rather than trying to find one of those other services? So I've taken us way beyond time. Sorry, guys, but thanks.
That's okay.
That's okay. Now we've got a follow-up for next week from Tim on how to use dry loops.
Yeah.
Oh, that's perfect.
Okay, well, let's move along. Chris already mentioned that this is the last call for our 2-for-1 special. So if anybody isn't a member and would like to be, or knows somebody who would like to be a member, if you join now, in the next few days, until March 31st, $20 will get you 2 years of membership. So it's 2 years for the price of one, but only until the end of this month. Our next monthly meeting will be April the 12th. Stefan Richard is going to be talking about bits and bytes and computers. That's something to look forward to. And I mentioned last week that the May meeting will be members' favorites. And we need some presentations. So send us an outline, or alternatively, it's going to be a really short meeting. And then finally, next week will be our regular question and answer session, April the 5th, I believe. So the cupboard is pretty well bare again. So if you have questions or you've got topics that you want to share, anybody got another romance scam? It would be good to know about. Send us the information to suggestion box and we'll be happy to reserve a slot for you. So thanks again to everyone who came across last week and produced all this great material. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks.
Thank you.
Have a good night, everyone.